Major funding for NJ Spotlight News is provided in part by NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years, and by the PSCG Foundation.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, underprepared for the next public health emergency. A deeper dive into the nearly 1,000-page COVID response report reveals the state is lacking proper funding and resources to battle our next outbreak.
You have to build the trust, and none of these reports really talk about how you build up a public health workforce that then is going to be equipped to work with people, because people are making the decisions that make these pandemics spread.
Plus, Congressman Andy Kim is the big winner in Mercer County. The momentum to replace Senator Bob Menendez shifting back in his favor for now.
Any convention where we've seen that has an open process, you know, secret ballots and not adding all sorts of other random delegates at the last minute, I seem to be doing just fine.
Also, Patterson launches a community court program as an alternative to jail for low-level, nonviolent offenders.
This is bringing justice for all. Justice for all. And I think the community, black and brown community, that thinks that we don't think on them, we're thinking on them.
And Edge, New Jersey, a safe haven to end discrimination, gain equality for members of the LGBTQ plus community needing health care or housing. NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJ PBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening and thanks for joining us this Tuesday night. I'm Brianna Venosi. A massive independent review of the state's COVID-19 response finds New Jersey's lack of preparedness led to unnecessary deaths and suffering. The long-awaited review out this week fulfills Governor Murphy's promise to provide a post-mortem on the most dangerous pandemic in a century, which sickened nearly 3 million people statewide and killed more than 33,000. The roughly 1,000-page report gives credit to the pandemic's heroes, but criticizes the state government for a patchwork response that hit the most vulnerable in New Jersey the hardest. And a senior correspondent, Brenda Flanagan, reports, reveals that even in the years since, the state still hasn't come up with a future emergency plan.
Leadership would have made a difference.
Jay Boxwell spent anxious hours at Jersey's veterans' homes demanding action as COVID's first surge cut like a scythe through the state-run facilities in Menlo Park and Paramus, killing almost 200 residents in April alone. By September, grieving families and angry staff knew something was very wrong.
Horrible. Horrible. They want us to work without masks because it's going to scare the resident. And when we see they're just dropping like flies, that's breaking our heart.
State officials witnessed that tragedy unfolding at the vets' homes and at long-term care facilities where more than 16,000 died, most of them elderly and vulnerable. The governor promised a full accounting, which arrived this week in a massive report that documents New Jersey's response to the pandemic. At the two vets' homes, it found systemic failures, poor infection control, lack of employee confidence in leadership, and management incompetence.
Menlo Park and Paramus, at the beginning, had soldiers running those facilities. Okay? They did not have clinical healthcare background whatsoever.
But if we would have had some skilled leaders in those positions, I think we could have minimized the impact that there could have been for some fragile individuals that passed away unnecessarily, I feel.
The report blames the federal government for failing to provide critical guidance and says COVID caught New Jersey's healthcare system off guard and woefully unprepared. It notes that by February, the virus was already out, spreading like wildfire through the community, infecting long-term care centers.
There is like an admission of things that went right and that things that went wrong. So we should have been reacting in real time to those situations, and we weren't. And so how does the report tell us about how to do that effectively in the future? I don't think the report tells us that. at all.
It does describe how patients overwhelmed hospitals already struggling to find protective gear, so health officials hoarded masks for medical centers, and in the early months, nursing homes went without. David Adenaro was an assistant health commissioner during the pandemic.
Nobody had enough PPE. I think that's one of the really important things that's stressed in the report, which is that preparation and proper stockpiling is going to be important, not just for New Jersey, but also for all other states, and in particular, the federal government.
The report commends the governor's quick response, locking down the state and closing schools, but it adds letting individual districts decide when to reopen classrooms contributed to learning loss because urban districts couldn't provide the required social distancing. Overall, COVID hit low-income minority communities much harder, underscoring pre-existing inequities, the report says.
And I think it talked about employment status, for example, and how certain occupations were more likely to be exposed and have less access to healthcare. Well, those were almost, at least early on, largely occupied by communities of color and low-income population.
The NJEA responded to the report, noting, "We believe that in-person instruction is the gold standard for effective teaching and learning, but that had to be balanced against the very real health risks of in-person instruction early in the pandemic, particularly before vaccines were universally available." The report also says state officials failed to activate an existing flu pandemic plan, leaving local health departments scrambling. Even after coping with COVID for 4 years, the report concludes New Jersey's not ready for the next pandemic.
You have to build the trust, and none of these reports really talk about how you build up a public health workforce that then is going to be equipped to work with people, because people are making the decisions that make these pandemics spread.
Public health experts hope the next administration learns from the deadly mistakes made by this one. I'm Brenda Flanagan, NJ Spotlight News.
New Jersey did have a statewide influenza pandemic plan and a playbook to deal with other large-scale health hazards. But those resources weren't of much value during the coronavirus outbreak because, according to the report, most state leaders weren't aware a strategy existed, and very few in the higher echelons of government had ever been trained on it. That was perhaps one of the most glaring examples of how New Jersey failed to respond to the outbreak. Our healthcare writer Lilo Stainton joins me now for a deeper look. Lilo, of course, I don't think anyone can deny that this is a very thorough report at nearly 1,000 pages, but what stuck out to you? Because we have had other reports about different areas of the pandemic response.
Right. I think, one of the things that stuck out was the totality of it. It really was comprehensive. And it went back, you know, as far as there was an entire section on planning, which I was really struck by. And it went all the way back to, you know, the 1918-1920 pandemic that, you know, really has been seen in a lot of ways as a model for, you know, responses, and has really informed a lot of the United States public health decisions ever since then. So, I was struck by the fact that the state did have a lot of plans, but also that none of them seemed to be particularly appropriate for this scenario, and that none of those plans really came up.
Yeah, and I think that was the question that a lot of us, as we were reading this report, were asking, which was why. I mean, it went into great detail about after scares from Ebola and in 2015 an influenza pandemic plan, and yet state leaders weren't made evidently aware that these plans existed, and the government didn't implement them. So why was there such a lack of preparedness when there were tools apparently at their disposal?
I mean, that's a hard question to answer. It's a great question. I think part of it has to do with the nature of public health. I mean, local public health officials constantly stress to me that the work that we do, when we're doing it right, we remain invisible, right? It's about prevention. So if you don't see diseases, if you don't see food illnesses, then, you know, their work is going well. This was a situation where we were overwhelming our public health structure. And another thing that stuck out to me in the report was that Paul Zubeck, the attorney, noted that, you know, they went into the details of the different emergency laws and plans that were, you know, that could have been applicable. And a lot of them put the Department of Health in the driver's seat in this type of a situation, but none of them equipped the Department of Health or local health departments with any additional resources. On contrary, you know, post 9/11, we saw a lot of sort of law enforcement, counterterrorism, biohazard type threat, and it builds up, you know, in response to that. And, you know, law enforcement agencies appeared to do a lot with that. So the question, you know, why can't we build a complementary public health system defense like right. that? I don't know.
So lack of investment in the public health infrastructure. But did we get any insight on what metrics, if any, were being used by the administration when making the decisions that they did?
That was something that one of the recommendations certainly was, we need clearer metrics for decision making. And the report, you know, Mr. Zubeck credits the government, the Murphy administration, for doing, you know, the robust response that they did. But he points out in several places that, you know, if Governor Murphy, Health Commissioner Percy Kelly, and State Police Colonel Patrick Callahan hadn't gotten along, and they got along famously, it appears, if that hadn't been the case, none of this would have worked. You know, what if one of them had gotten sick? What if Murphy's cancer surgery had gone wrong? And, you know, not to say that Sheila Oliver couldn't have led this, but they were just the sort of contingency plans weren't there. And it really, a lot of things that happened in this pandemic were because people stepped up and did extraordinary things. But what if they hadn't?
Relying on a lot of luck there. Lilo Stainton for us. Lilo, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bray.
It's lucky number 7 for U.S. Senate candidate and Congressman Andy Kim, who last night won the Mercer County Democratic Convention with 63% of the vote, beating out First Lady Tammy Murphy for the party line endorsement there. Both candidates have been racking up critical support heading into the June primary, but political analysts say they're watching closely for victories in counties like Mercer, where endorsements are decided through secret ballot votes rather than the thumb of party bosses. Ted Goldberg reports.
For Tammy Murphy, 108 votes, and for Andy Kim, 230.
Anytime we show that, you know, we're able to operate in a non-machine county, when we let people be able to vote, you know, we'd be able to win very significantly. And I think that this bodes really well for what's going to happen on June 4th.
Another secret ballot and another convention win for Andy Kim, who has now captured the county line in 7 counties. Kim had home field advantage with much of his congressional district in Mercer County, but the county also includes Trenton, so you couldn't count out First Lady Tammy Murphy.
I am here standing before you not just as a candidate for Senate, not just as a three-term member of the House of Representatives, but as a father of a 6-year-old and 8-year-old. Terrified about what kind of America they're going to grow up in.
I see the world through the eyes of my children, my 4 children, and we are really letting down the next generation. Whether it's 2 wars that are ongoing, whether it's mental health challenges, whether it's affordability, whether it's an attack on our reproductive freedoms.
Murphy only needed 40% of the vote to share the county line, but she ended up with just 29% of the vote, so Kim gets the line solo. Afterwards, Murphy said she's not too worried about conventions, even after her big wins in Bergen and Somerset counties and getting the party's endorsement in Passaic and Union.
There's a lot of conventions, but I'll be really happy when the conventions are over and we can just get on the ground and be able to talk to people, because that's where I shine, you know, when I'm actually able to talk to people and not just running from one place to the other and not able to really have a good conversation.
As for Kim, he was pleased that Mercer County used a secret ballot. Conventions using secret ballots have leaned his way during the campaign.
Any convention where we've seen that just has an open process, you know, secret ballots and not adding all sorts of other random delegates at the last minute, I seem to be doing just fine. There should be really no reason not to do a secret ballot anywhere in America when there is a contested race. It just is the right thing to do to just make sure people are able to do what they want to do. It's a real a sign of respect for voters.
When you know that you're being watched and you're being watched by people who have a vested outcome in how you vote, it's not so secret. It's not so easy to vote your conscience.
Last night's convention was held at Rider University, where Micah Rasmussen teaches political science. He said these results demonstrate the hold Kim has in his home district.
To me, that signals that Andy Kim has very strong support throughout all of the four counties that touch his congressional district or that he used to represent in Congress. He's got a very strong base in Monmouth, Ocean, Burlington, and Mercer.
While Kim got the Democratic nod in Mercer County, neither candidate could claim victory in Cape May County. The Democrats there chose not to endorse him or Murphy for the county line. Rasmussen says the next few conventions will be an interesting battle between Kim and the Democratic machine.
This is really shaping up to be a primary very much about those who have the power versus those who don't. And there are a lot more voters who don't have power. And ultimately, if they choose to participate, then Andy Kim's got this strong grassroots secret weapon on his side.
Kim hopes to ride this wave into Middlesex County, where delegates there will cast their votes on Thursday. At Rider University, I'm Ted Goldberg, NJ Spotlight News.
In Patterson, an alternative to jail for some low-level nonviolent offenders. The city this week launched a community court program that'll offer people a second chance before they get caught up in the criminal justice system by intervening with services like mental health care, substance abuse treatment, and job training. As Melissa Rose Cooper reports, the program is considered a transformative approach to helping people get and keep their lives on track.
Patterson is a city of second chances, and that improving public safety requires a compassionate and holistic approach. And this is the last piece to what we're trying to do.
Patterson Mayor Andre Saya applauding the city's latest program to foster rehabilitation and further empower its residents. The Community Courts Initiative will give those who've committed low-level nonviolent crimes a way to get back on the right path without facing arrest.
Ultimately, our objective is to provide access to resources that may not have been readily available in the past. But now, City Hall is essentially becoming a one-stop shop for people who have been recently released from prison or jail, for people that unfortunately are struggling financially, for people that have been struggling with addiction for far too long, and now for people who get caught up in the criminal justice system, not only clog the courts, but also impair their opportunities to advance in society. So I mean it when I say that the creation of a community court in Patterson represents a victory for those individuals whose only crime was that they didn't have the connection.
The program is being made possible with the help of a $600,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Justice and will operate within the Patterson Municipal Court.
There will be a screening process, and the individuals will go through that screening process. It will include members of the community court staff, as well as their attorneys, the defense attorneys, our prosecutors. And again, the goal here is to start with this, but maximize it. And what do I mean by that is people who have large fines and may have suspended licenses. We want the community court to be a place where people can come and seek redress for those issues without having to be arrested, with minimizing the amount of contact with our law enforcement partners, so that our court is a place where not only people can go in, but they can also come out and come out and continue their lives in a meaningful way.
The community court will include a dedicated team of professionals specializing in behavioral health and social services to ensure residents who have been charged with a low-level crime get the proper attention they need.
I am a licensed mental health counselor in the state of New York and a licensed professional counselor in the state of New Jersey. My research experience has included better understanding quality of life issues that affect communities of color, as well as informing political research, I'm so sorry, policy research around increasing access to mental health care and rehabilitative services. I look forward to leading this initiative and want to really focus on connecting this community to vital resources that they need to address the root causes of their cases.
This is bringing justice for all. Justice for all. And I think the community, the black and brown community, that things that we don't think on them, we're thinking on them. Because most affected are black and brown communities. Yeah. Let's be honest. So we are thinking on them. We're bringing justice for all. Take chance at the opportunity that the city is giving you to be a better person tomorrow.
Plans are also in the works to expand the community core to include other services, like enrolling people in community college so they can take the next steps in reaching new goals. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Melissa Rose Cooper.
In our Spotlight on Business report tonight, if you want to know which bills got the most attention in Trenton last year, just follow the money trail. An annual report from New Jersey's Election Law Enforcement Commission shows government lobbyists spent just over $96 million in 2023. That's up just slightly from the roughly $95 million they spent the year prior. No surprise here that last year's state budget attracted the most lobbying activity. But according to the spending report, there was also outsized interest in legislation related to reforming drug prices, state liquor license laws, and protections for temporary workers. So who were the top spenders? According to the ELAC records, the Operating Engineers Union and PSE&G held the number one and two spots, followed by groups like AARP New Jersey and the League of Municipalities. And PSE&G is a funder of NJ Spotlight News. On Wall Street, stocks marched higher today after new inflation data showed consumer prices were up more than forecasters expected, an increase of 0.4% for February and 3.2% higher than a year ago. That's being led by a rise in the price of gas and shelter, while food prices, they remained flat. Here's how the markets reacted.
Support for the Business Report provided by the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce. Announcing its ReNew Jersey Business Summit and Expo, March 26th and 27th at Harrah's in Atlantic City. Event details online at njchamber.com.
Finally tonight, an organization founded decades ago to support people living with HIV/AIDS is serving a new purpose with a similar mission. Edge NJ is now extending its services to the LGBTQ plus community. It's the only Pride and Wellness Center in Morris County offering health care, help with housing, and behavioral needs. Services advocates say are severely lacking for the population. This week, the office officially opened its doors after relocating to a new location, and our senior correspondent, Joanna Gagas, was there.
My kid came out during the pandemic, and they were flourishing in their personality until we ended up going back to school. We encountered a lot of bullying because they were LGBTQ, and I needed to find resources.
Maria Chacon and her child found that solace and support at a nonprofit in Morris County called EDGE, which stands for End Discrimination, Gain Equality. They're like so many of the people and families who come here.
They're looking for a place to feel included. They're looking for a place to be represented and not feel different. They're looking for a space where they can have community.
And that's exactly what EDGE offers, says its COO, Joanne McInnery. It started in 1994, serving individuals with HIV, but transitioned a few years ago to also serve the needs of the LGBTQ community.
We also see a lot of people who are facing social determinants of health, adults, a lack of access to housing, lack of access to transportation, health care, mental health services.
They have a housing program for young people ages 18 to 24 who find themselves homeless either because of discrimination or because they've been kicked out of their parents' home. And they have a number of programs geared specifically to young people ages 13 to 18.
We provide low to no cost counseling services, compassion, a listening ear, a space where they can feel safe and brave, patience and non-judgment. That's all it takes, right? That it doesn't take more than that to be able to see the change, the life change that takes for these people once they're connected to care.
their licensed clinicians accept insurance, part of the reason why they have a 44-person wait list right now for people seeking mental health care.
We have support groups as well, youth support groups. We do a lot of linkage to affirming medical care.
6 months ago, Edge had to vacate their office space, forcing them to go remote with all of their services. They just moved into this new space in Parsippany a week ago and are excited to bring back all of their in-person services like counseling and peer support groups.
We just had our first game night last night, and we had, you know, a mixture of youth and longstanding members who were so happy to be here. They even wanted to record a video to send to, you know, some of our higher ups here just to show their gratefulness that the space is open again, you know, being remote in between spaces. And I think that was tough on some of our members because Edge New Jersey is one of the only safe spaces for them to come and be a part of a community.
And yet, even with the need so great, other LGBTQ organizations like CAN, a medical service provider, have recently closed their doors, only adding to the demand for support services from Edge.
We know that when we don't provide the youth the services they need, they're faced with all too tragic outcomes. We lost one of our youth a year ago, and it was horrible. And, you know, this could be prevented if there were more services available to our young people.
An alarming 41% of LGBTQ youth considered attempting suicide. So for Chacon, having this Edge support for her child is life-changing.
If there is anything going on, the clinician alerts me, and we start working on how do we resolve it? How do we best support it? For me, this is a very good place to be.
They're holding their first in-person support group tonight in the new space, bringing back that support that so many have been missing. In Parsippany, I'm Joanna Gagas, NJ Spotlight News.
And that does it for us tonight. But don't forget to download the NJ Spotlight News podcast so you can listen anytime. I'm Brianna Venosi for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child. And RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together.